My name is Lawrence Allen.
Hi, this is Claude Myron Guzer from the Cannonball Podcast.
And this is Adapt or Die, a Bad Time Radio sideshow.
And thanks, Kurt.
Welcome to another episode of Lawrence and Claude's sideshow, titled TBD, possibly Adapt or Die, although there's also a million other things called that. And today, we're still refining the format, but we're covering The Damned Thing. We have three different versions of it. First, the original Ambrose Bierce short story, which we have both read. Then the Masters of Horror adaptation, which we have both watched, although it was a mistake to do so. And finally, we have listened to the frankly baffling episode of the CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
So, well, hang on. I think the film version was more baffling than the radio show version.
Now, we'll get to this in a second. Okay, first, let's just, again, refine the format a little. Let's just, would you recommend any of these? And if so, which ones and why, but non-spoilery.
Okay. I would definitely recommend the Bierce story. If you haven't read Bierce, you got to check out Bierce. If you're a horror fan or just a fan of fiction, Bierce is a really sort of fascinating character, and his stories are interesting for their very, very grim turn in the late 19th century. And I can speak some more to that, you know, later. He stands out amongst 19th century American fiction authors, just in his tone, his attitude, and in the weirdness of what he writes.
Yeah.
I kind of would recommend the film adaptation, and I hesitate to call it an adaptation. It's a recommendation with hesitation. I mean, going into it, you got to know that you're not getting an adaptation of Bierce's story. You're getting a kind of, it's something else entirely different. But it has its charm, not least of which is Ted Raimi as a priest. So that was kind of amusing, at least for me. And then the CBS Mystery Theater one, I'm up in the air because it does some of what the story does, but then diverges so much that I feel like there's got to be some kind of better audio adaptation out there somewhere. I would say like an audiobook adaptation of the original story might be more appropriate, or even like LibriVox. Do you know LibriVox?
Yeah, I actually listened to a LibriVox recording of this while I was out running this morning, and there's a perfectly fine version of it in YouTube. You know, standard for LibriVox, it's not going to set the world on fire with its narrations or anything, but it's perfectly serviceable.
Yeah, I'd say that would probably do you better than the CBS Mystery Theater one.
Yeah. As for me, obviously read the Ambrose Bierce short story, read all of Ambrose Bierce. We'll talk about him a bit, but he's one of my two favorite 19th century authors. He's incredible. He did shit with fiction that no one had even thought of before, and that precious few people think of to do now, except when they're just consciously or unconsciously ripping him off. The movie is 55 minutes. If you're like, I want 55 minutes of mid-2000s, slightly okay horror on a low budget, it's fine. It's a terrible adaptation of the book. Yeah, because they lift a scene and the title and nothing else. And it's like, why were you so eager to cash in on the Ambrose Bierce craze that you bothered even lifting the title?
And we have to note that you're being ironic about the Ambrose Bierce craze. Right?
Exactly. A true story. I went to grad school in English for about 5 weeks. And part of the reason I stopped doing that was that I very much wanted to specialize in Ambrose Bierce. Among other things, there is a bunch of his uncollected writings sitting in archives in San Francisco, which means that there's a pretty easy doctoral thesis just sitting there for anyone who wants to do it, and cataloging and studying and doing a first brush over it, you know?
All right, well, I'll see you later, man. I got a book to get to San Francisco. I think I may have a job.
Yeah, but I was told that I should not do that. Or at least I should not tell people that I plan to do it, because Ambrose Bierce was a second-rate author and I would not be taken seriously in my department.
Oh,
so,
what the hell with that?
And the University of New Mexico actually weirdly has a pretty strong 19th century American literature department, or it did at one point until Gary Scharnhorst left. So it's pretty fucking weird that there's this like, nah, this dude. So there's never been an Ambrose Bierce craze, and there probably never will be. Okay. Yeah. And,
talk about that in a second. Put a pin in that. I want to come back to that because I'm actually surprised that there hasn't been an uptick in interest in beers.
Yeah. We'll come back to that. And finally, the radio show. I say listen to it after the story. I will talk about this. It is incompetent in a way that I am baffled by, and I can't tell if it's deliberate and doing a thing or not. But I have never. I don't think I've heard episodes of the CBS Radio Mystery Theater that were more boring than it, or that had like weirder, more laughable elements. I have never heard one that, on a basic structural level, was this incompetent or disjointed. And for that reason, it's noteworthy, and maybe give it a listen. Although, as always, on these 1.2, 1.3 speed is your friend.
Right. All right. Well, with that being said, where do you want to start?
So let's just do a brief overview of Ambrose Bierce. So before you go like deep scholarly on him, you cool if I flex what little scholarly muscles I have left?
Dude, go.
So first off, for a much better and more in-depth discussion of this, you should check out the Agora podcast that Claude and Dan did on Ambrose Bierce. I actually have a little cameo on that. See if you can spot me. I don't care to explain it further than that. But he's a 19th century author. His work is broadly divided into three categories. Fables, which tend to be kind of funny, although also pretty like depressing. For Hayesha the Shepherd is literally about how it's impossible for humans to attain happiness, for instance. It's also kind of an important story if you're really interested in the Hastur mythos, because that's where Robert W. Chambers got the names Hastur, and then an inhabitant of Carcosa is where he got the names Carcosa and Holly. Although he just took the names and nothing else. But he has fables, he has war stories, which are some of the nastiest stories that anyone has ever written in English, I think. And then he's got horror stories. His horror stories and his war stories both tend to be mostly dedicated to the subject of, a nihilism so pure that it goes past life has no meaning to things like your senses are untrustworthy and language doesn't work, which is an incredible thing for any author to like attack the idea that there should be literature, kind of. And his other passion was fucking with the reader. So his most famous stories are probably Chickamauga, the Damned Thing, and Death of Halpin Frazier. And I'm also going to throw the Moonlit Road in it. Oh, did I say Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge? Did I forget the most famous one?
Yeah, I think that would be his most famous, where it's just the king of all twist endings. He was dead the whole time.
Well, he was dying the whole time. And between all of these, they're just like dedicated in some way or another to pulling the rug out from under the reader. This is as close as he got to writing a straight story. And even this, it's got kind of a sideline in your eyes don't work, which is weird. And then, as every discussion of Ambrose Bierce must mention, he fought apparently gallantly in the Civil War on the Union side. He was still low-key kind of racist. He's got some kind of gross things about African Americans in the Devil's Dictionary. But on the other hand, I kind of feel you got to give a 19th century guy who got injured very badly in the Civil War trying to free all the slaves as a kind of a pass on racism. Although I don't think he actually fought because he cared much about abolitionism. But still, you know, actions matter more than motives. And then he was injured, I believe it was a head wound, while scouting. And then after, he had a kind of an illustrious career as a newspaperman after. He never really broke it through to the level of like a Mark Twain or something, but he had a pretty comfortable existence writing short stories and editing newspapers in San Francisco. And then after a series of personal tragedies when he was quite old, he said, fuck it, and went and covered the Mexican Civil War and disappeared.
Yeah. He was most likely killed in the fighting. And,
or maybe he got eaten by vampires, as will one of the latter day From Dusk Till Dawn sequels posits.
I was about to bring that up. And I think, who was it? Was it Carlos Fuentes wrote a novel about the last days of Ambrose Bierce or something? The Old Gringo.
Yeah.
I might be mixing that up. But anyway, his disappearance is kind of legendary.
Every time anyone talks about Ambrose Bierce, they bring up the disappearance. It's kind of weird. Right. I mean, it's noteworthy, but it's also kind of weird that that's the one thing people bring up. I think the fact that he, you know, took a head wound in the Civil War and came back from it is kind of as fascinating, but whatever.
From what I read from, and I'm relying on the Dictionary of Literary Biography, he joined up because he wanted to, you know, engage in a career as a soldier. Like, that's how he thought of himself. And he was just kind of stymied and frustrated in that. But he also, like, he did fight valiantly. That is sort of on the record. But he came away from it not really relishing the valor of warfare. I mean, his experiences in war greatly contributed to his nihilism. I mean,
yeah,
he was sort of like, you know, there's no point to any of this. Violence and violence.
So I believe in the introduction to the collected works of Ambrose Bierce, they actually describe his war stories, when you put them together, as the greatest anti-war like literature ever produced in English.
Yeah,
it's not even like it. It's go read Chickamauga, guys. It will fuck you up, and then, you know, tell me the war is good afterwards. You won't be able to because you'll be too fucked up.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like I think about Bierce. Okay, the 19th century, like pre-Civil War, and then some of post-Civil War was very sort of like the attitude was a kind of cheerful, positive outlook. I mean, all right, mostly in the early part of the 19th century. I mean, I'm thinking of like Longfellow and sort of the popular fireside poets, and most of the popular stuff that was out there was very sort of pull yourself up by the bootstraps, you know, the good times are just around the corner. You just got to work hard and do your thing. And in the later 19th century, you have some authors really sort of expressing a kind of skepticism, especially around the turn of the century. I mean, I'm thinking of someone like Stephen Crane, but I think Crane, in a lot of ways, was kind of a pose. Like, he wrote Red Badge of Courage, but he was way too young. I mean, he was still a baby when the Civil War was going on. He was,
you
like,
know, here's an amazing factoid. He did such a good job on Red Badge of Courage that occasionally veterans would, like, write in and say that they had served with him and remembered him quite well.
Right. And it was a con. And the other thing was, I don't know if you've ever read his poetry. You might actually dig his poetry. Have you seen like The Black Rider and other poems?
No, my Crane is limited to Red Badge of Courage. And then I believe The Blue Hotel, the one about the Swede who gets fucked up.
Yeah. He wrote a whole bunch of poems that are sort of like in the vein of Emily Dickinson, except less obscure. And they're horrifically, I mean, they're sort of like horror stories as poems. They're like these grim, nihilistic, you know, weird little fragments, and they're kind of fascinating. But there's something about Crane which always strikes me as sort of like a pose. And with Bierce, I don't think it's a pose. I mean, it's sort of like, yeah, this is how things are. This is what we're dealing with. So if you want, I think you sort of advertise it well, if you want like that grimmest of possible nihilisms. You've got it. He expressed like this extraordinary skepticism at a time when the nation as a whole was trying to pull itself together and sort of cheerfully march on with manifest destiny. And I really read The Damned Thing in the context of manifest destiny as a sort of like, okay, you think you have power and control over the nation. You think you have power and control over the land or over the natural world or over the known. And it's just going to throw you off, dude. This is hubris, you know? So it's kind of an amazingly antithetical outlook to much of what the culture was going through.
Like, the only place I've ever encountered horror or nihilism that this is extreme, even Lovecraft was like, well, you know, human existence is, of course, pointless, but you can still, like, derive aesthetic pleasure from things. And Bierce is like, no, you can't, dude. You stop being stupid. Everything sucks. But the only place I've ever encountered nihilism that can touch his is, like, extreme horror authors who are just being mean for meanness' sake, which Bierce never did. In all the stories I've read, he's cruel to the reader. He's not nice to his characters. They still often come to grisly ends. But it's never quite like, that was excessive, dude. Why did you do that? Which happens quite a bit in the horror fiction I read.
Yeah, you don't feel that sense of sadism that he's like, all right.
Well, except towards the reader. He really does seem to hate the fucking reader sometimes.
Well, like, I think of someone like Flannery O'Connor, right? Like, she hates the reader, but she also hates all her characters. You know, and I don't feel that in Beers. I think you're right. But shall we get to the story itself?
Yeah, this is a pretty simple story. Although there is one weird thing I want to point out. Do you want to summarize or should I?
I'll go ahead and take it because I think I might have to lean on you a bit for the audio version. But yeah, it is a pretty simple, straightforward story. A sort of out in the frontier, out in the woods, in this town in the middle of nowhere. Sort of like on the outskirts, a bunch of people are meeting for an inquest. There's this dead body, and the coroner has to sort of officially state what happened. You've got witnesses, and then there's this newspaper man who knew the dead guy, who comes in to sort of give his testimony.
I don't think there are actually any other witnesses, which is in the inquest that we know of, at least. We don't see them.
No. But they're jurors.
Okay, that's
what I meant. They have to sign off on it.
That is something that we'll get to on the radio show that I found just absurd.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I'm not trying to digress. Yeah, they're jurors who have to sign off on it. And one of the jokes is that some of them don't even know how to write, but, you know, they can at least sign their names. So there's this journalist there who knew the dead guy who was with him, who writes this sort of piece about going out hunting with the guy. They see something moving, but there's nothing there. And his buddy wants to take a shot at what he calls the damned thing. And the newspaper guy, the reporter, records seeing trees waving, but there's nothing there. There's motion, but they can't see anything. And then his buddy Morgan, the dead guy, goes running off into the woods to try to get something, and then is torn to shreds by something that is invisible.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
One thing that occurred to me that I should have mentioned on the Ambrose Bierce thing, the other thing that recommends him is he has an absolutely diamond hard prose style that really comes through in a lot, especially this work, where he worked as a newspaper man and therefore was very adept at isolating the one or two details or things that would make establish a scene without him having to bother like really describing stuff. And the description of the coroner reading the ledger in particular is unbelievably creepy. Because he's like isolated in the description of the damned thing attacking, which Harker is his name. Harker in this one too.
Yeah, Harker.
Yeah, which Harker describes. It's not even that he can't see it. It's something weirder because he describes parts of the man being torn apart as sort of disappearing.
Yeah,
not just like, oh my God, I saw him being lifted aloft. It's like he could see him and then he couldn't. So the story will try to have a scientific explanation, which I'm not qualified to say or something else. But the thing it appears to be describing isn't even an invisible monster. It's a monster who something about it will not let your eyes comprehend it.
Yeah.
Which is the whole, like, you can't trust your senses, bro. Because an invisible thing you could kind of get, but this, it's, yeah.
Well, hang on to that. I want to come back to the distrust of the senses because there's a whole other thing going on there that I could digress on. Or do you want me to digress on it now?
Let's hit it, man.
Okay.
I already broke your roll.
All right. So this came up when we were talking about when I was on the show before with the radio show from the BBC4 about the sort of aestheticist who goes to the French countryside to paint beautiful pictures of this woman being tortured and bled out and eaten, right? Aestheticism sort of parallels the Gothic. I had this isn't my idea. This is sort of like a running theory in 19th century, like Victorian lit. But a lot of times you have the aestheticist paralleling the Gothic, like the two are sort of like side by side in this weird way, because both deal with sensation. Does that make sense? Like the way that the Victorians approached the Gothic was similar to the way that the aestheticist approached sensation. So Oscar Wilde could write in Importance of Being Earnest, when one of the characters is, she has this line while they're waiting for the guy to bring down the handbag to prove that everything is all right and he can marry the woman he wants and there's a successful resolution. Gwendolyn, his putative fiance, says, "Oh, the suspense is killing me. I hope it never stops." It's the idea of excitation and suspense as sort of like wonderful aesthetic sensation, right? Well, the Gothic kind of works on the same side. Horror kind of works on the same side, that it's about arousal of the senses in some way, shape, or form. Even if it's horrifying or scary or weird or like over the top or you know, really terrifying, it's still a similar kind.
Okay, so Claude, you were saying? Sorry.
Oh, yeah, no problem. So like the sensation or the emphasis on sensation is there both in the Gothic and the aestheticist. So that's why Wilde could write something like The Importance of Being Earnest, which is very light and airy and fluffy. And most of Wilde's stuff is very light and fun, and it makes a sort of moral case for enjoyment. On the other hand, he's got something like Dorian Gray, which is this weird amoral case for aesthetic sensation, which goes very much into the nihilistic. So the two are sort of parallels. What I thought was kind of interesting is that here, sensation isn't even at issue. Like, it's something about how, you know, you can't even trust that. So it's sort of muted and dead and nullified. So much of the other writing that, you know, you're sort of recommending to me that we've been having, you know, this conversation off air, Chambers, like Robert W. Chambers, which, you know, you were recommending The King in Yellow, which was a great, you know, creepy piece. And then the Clark Ashton Smith stuff that you were recommending to me to read. Both of those, you know, Smith is in that pulpy tradition, but he was also a poet in the aestheticist kind of decadent tradition. And it's so fascinating how so much horror kind of spins off of the aestheticists. But Bierce is almost even antithetical to that, because he's sort of like, no, that doesn't even count, right? So the damn thing, I think, nullifies so much of that stuff with this weird monster that's not even sensorially comprehensible. So that's the end of my rant.
Yeah, now I'm going to point out something completely unrelated. Another thing about... so this story, and I'm not sure about this, Claude, you might have to, you know, hook me up with some knowledge, but I think this might be the first story to feature Cryptkeeper puns. Because listen to some of these chapter titles. One does not always eat what is on the table, referring to a tattered corpse. Let's see what else we got here. What may happen in a field of wild oats? Well, a man might get torn apart. A man, though naked, may be in rags, because again, he got torn apart by a weird invisible monster thing. And finally, an explanation from the tomb, which is not a joke, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, these are some grim, like, this is some dark irony, this is some dark sarcasm, which is, like, straight up in that's straight up Bierce, like, the Devil's Dictionary, you know? I know that there are, I guess, more self-aware chapter titles, but you'd have to go to something like Don Quixote or Tristram Shandy or something like that to get to them. You know, hey, another bizarre aside, do you want to know my absolute favorite chapter title of all time?
Hit me.
Okay. Have you ever read The Man Without Qualities by Robert Musil?
Yes, of course. It's my favorite book, this random thing you've just said that I'm not sure exists.
This 3,000-page unfinished novel by an Austrian modernist. Yeah, you haven't read that one? No, it's a phenomenally funny book about sort of like the descent into World War I in Austria. And it follows this guy, Ulrich, who is the titular man without qualities because he's just aimless and just sort of like floating through life. But it starts out with chapter one, in which surprisingly little actually occurs. So that's my favorite chapter title of all time. It begins with this paragraph describing, like, in minute detail, like the barometric pressure, the temperature, all kinds of like atmospheric stuff. And it concludes the paragraph. So in short, it was a nice day in Austria in 1909. That's it.
Sounds like a real winner, Klaus.
It's funny, man, but it's worth checking out. Anyway, so the Harker, the journalist, sort of reads from his piece this write-up that he has about the what happened to his buddy. And then the coroner and everybody else sort of rise and say, yeah, it was a mountain lion.
Well, Harker is also like, hey, you want to maybe read from that journal? And the coroner's like, no, that has no entry. And that doesn't matter at all to this. So we're not going to do that.
Yeah,
Harker just kind of leaves.
Yeah, so Morgan left a journal and the coroner says, everybody says, nah, mountain lion. But some of us thinks all the same they had fits. Like, so something was kind of funky here, but I don't know. It was a mountain lion. Let's go home. But then in the fourth section or the fourth chapter, we get the journal entries, which are sort of like Morgan's descent into madness as he's convinced that there's this thing that he can't see. And he has this kind of scientific-ish hypothesis that there are colors that resist human comprehension, and there's this other thing out there, or that there are other things in the world that we cannot sense or we cannot know, but they can be dangerous and deadly and will come and kill us. I mean, it's really kind of fascinating, like the way they describe the damned thing. It's kind of like the Predator, you know, the telltale shimmer. And he's just this thing that is kind of there, but not there. It's you know, really kind of cool, but it's a great creepy story, you know? So.
Yeah. I think it still might count as a lesser Bierce just because it isn't doing anything like incredible with the form. But as far as like a horror story goes, it's pretty good. It'll freak you out. It's got a couple of funny jokes. This one you should definitely check out.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Then let's do the movie. I think we can blow through this pretty quick because, well, I'll give a very, very brief summary, in part because I don't have very many notes on it. So we open with a boy whose father suddenly goes crazy and tries to kill him before being torn apart by an invisible force. This is the only thing it has in common with the story of the damned thing, is that there is a scene of a man being torn apart by something invisible. And even that is kind of not true, because in the damned thing, it's not invisible. It's something weirder that doesn't really go into language, apparently. Right. Then we fast forward. The man is now a sheriff in a small town. It's a pretty idyllic, like, southern town. Oh, also, this thing is directed by Tobe Hooper, which I thought was pretty... I mean, I'm not going to claim that he's, like, an amazing director. I think he's got far more misses than hits, but it's still weird seeing his stamp on something this absolutely mediocre. Because normally even his failures are, just, are like, weird nonsense, you know?
Life force.
Yeah. But anyways, it's an idyllic town. The sheriff is divorced from his wife because he's too paranoid about the damned thing coming back. The town, he's got, there's a sinister newspaper running around and a priest who's played by Ted Raimi, but seems initially kind of nice. Then he's got a dumbass deputy. The town gradually goes crazier and crazier, as apparently another town did a long time before. Eventually, everyone in town, we don't actually see the town go crazy because that kind of thing costs money and Masters of Horror didn't really have any. Eventually, the sheriff, it goes crazy as well and attempts to kill his child, but snaps out of it before he can. And then at the very end, as his wife and son are trying to escape, he gets eaten by what appears to be an oil monster. And it turns out that the reason all of this is happening is because his father was part of a crew that dug something up a long time ago. And it killed the town that dug him up, but was coming after his father eventually. And then after him, because I guess he's related to his father. They don't really explain if it's going to come after his kid eventually or not. I don't know. It's fine. It's not particularly scary. I don't think it's one of the better Masters of Horrors, but it's only 50 minutes. And I mean, you get to see Ted Raimi go crazy and really, really ham it up towards the end. So, I mean, if it were a movie, that wouldn't be enough to sell you on it. At 50 minutes, it might be.
Yeah, it's weird, right? Like, why? Okay, I guess we're going to get into this when we also talk about the radio play version of this. But the question is, why do it like this? Okay, so thematically, it's linked in some way because, all right, they dug up an oil monster. And that's, I think that can be linked to American hubris as well. Like this drive for resources, that causes us to do something to the environment, which strikes back in some way. And I think that, I mean, that's how I've sort of been reading some of Bierce's texts. Like, it's about hubris in some way. We think we've mastered the environment, and the environment has things in it that cannot be mastered, that cannot even be understood by the human brain, right? So it's got some kind of thematic link there. And this was made in the early, like 2004, 2005, was it?
They would have probably aired around 2005, 2006.
Okay, right. So it's around the time of Afghanistan and Iraq, and anything having to do with oil necessarily sort of like plays into that sort of national discourse, whether it wants to or not. So it's got some of that going on. But here's the question. All right, Masters of Horror, they didn't have a huge budget, and they were trying to see what some of their big name directors could do with certain kinds of limitations, right?
And, well, the basic production premise of Masters of Horror was that there were a lot of like pretty good horror guys who often would have trouble getting financing for their projects. So they would get small budgets, but in return they would be given, I believe, total or near total artistic freedom, and they didn't have to worry about financing or scrabbling or fighting with the money men or anything. And because it was on Showtime, they could show some pretty grody violence. So yeah, you actually have some kind of amazing names, like John Carpenter did two.
Right.
You've got John Landis, Tobe Hooper. Mick Garris kind of sucks, but Dario Argento did one.
Right.
Stuart Gordon did two. Lucky McKee, who, you know, he's not like classic horror director, but he made May, which is pretty amazing. Yeah. So, you know.
Yeah, so, you know, the format sort of opens itself up to kinds of exploration, right? And even if you have limitations or you have a limited budget, there are things you could do. And there are things that you could do with this story. Because
I mean, the fact that the monster's fucking invisible seems like it really lends itself quite well to a low-budget production, and instead they're like, nah, I want to see the monster. And it's like, what the shit, dude? That's like the thing about the story, is that you can't see it.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Like, you could very easily... Okay, look. If you did a straight adaptation, you would have at most two sets. That's it. You would have, like, the hut, or the shack, with the body... And then a field.
And then I guess you could maybe have, I think that if you were going to do an adaptation, a better gimmick would be to show you slowly going insane while the guy's reading the journal, essentially, or whatever, the main guy.
Wow.
Yeah. So you'd need a few more, but I think the real problem with adapting this, honestly, is that when you read it out loud with all the descriptions and everything, it's 20 minutes.
Yeah, I think you could stretch it out with the slow burn, right? And I think you could do that with limited resources. And I mean, look, you only really need maybe three main actors and five stand-ins, you know, or five just, you know, random people. Like, you could really work this together, and you could really, you know, you could turn it into something. That's all I'm saying.
I think if I were going to try to adapt this, what I would do, and this is a bit hack work, but it would work in terms of just, I want to turn this into a pretty standard horror movie, and then I can wring a lot of suspense out of the unique nature of the monster, is people, for whatever reason, you need more than one, they go to the cabin, they discover the journal, they read about the guy going insane, and then the damned thing starts stalking them while they're trapped there, you know?
No, I was going to say, like, you could Evil Dead this. That's true. But, like, there's so many ways to adapt it, so why do it like this?
Yeah, and you mentioned that you thought there would be some kind of Ambrose Bierce craze happening, but this is an in-name-only adaptation from a story that basically no one who isn't a weirdo horror nerd has heard of, and I find that absurd. Because normally you do an in-name-only adaptation because you want to cash in on the cachet of whatever the thing is. And I was kind of curious when I saw that it was an adaptation of the damned thing. I might literally be like one of five people in America who was, you know?
Yeah, that's the... Okay, that is really bizarre. But then, all right, the reason I think, I'm sorry, I brought that up and I want to come back to it. The reason I think there should be an Ambrose Bierce revival or a craze or something like that is because I also sort of think there probably should be a sharp uptick in interest in Gilded Age writing, because there's so many parallels to the contemporary moment. Cultural parallels and literary parallels, just in terms of how publishing functions. It's honestly surprising to me that there hasn't been this huge scholarly interest in the Gilded Age. And I would sort of put Bierce in that framework. In terms of just in terms of like financial inequality, in terms of how readership functions and cultural divides in readership, in terms of the sort of economic downturns that caused very, very similar sort of cultural reactions, in terms of, you know, endless colonial wars that basically add up to nothing. It's like we're living the 1880s and 1890s all over again, and we're too stupid to realize it. So I honestly thought that there should be like a real scholarly interest in Bierce, because so much of what he did, so much of what he had to say, his weird situation as a journalist. As a journalist, he worked for Hearst. He worked for the Hearst papers in San Francisco, and he was virulently anti Spanish-American War. So he just occupies this very odd position, and you know, I thought that this would be perfect, and it really surprised me when you told me that you were actively discouraged from doing research in Bierce. I think now is the time to do research in Bierce. But anyway, I'll get off my high horse. Why would Tobe Hooper adapt this goddamn story?
And the other weird thing is the guy who did the adaptation was Richard Christian Matheson, who isn't right. Like as big of a deal as Richard Matheson, but still, I mean, he's a horror author who's like has chops and knows how to do this shit. It's very weird.
Yeah, so I don't know what happened. I would be curious to find out, like, you know, I didn't have time to do a whole lot of delving into this, but I would be curious to find out, like, what the fuck happened?
I mean, I guess my part of the issue is that it does look like most, but not all of these are adaptations of things.
Okay.
But not all of them, though. It looks like they had a sort of a preference for it, maybe, but not like you have to do it. So it's very strange. Anyways, so I guess not short story good, movie bad. And let's move on to the just flat out crazy radio program.
Take it away.
Actually, Claude, I apologize for springing this on you, but I want to do a little bit of a segment with you right now.
All right, let's go.
It's called Claude's Accent Watch. Now, were there any accents in this that really were just like, wait, what the fuck, or what's going on, or reminded you of someone from your childhood, or anything like that?
This time around, not so much. There was a little bit of gun mall in a couple of the women, like especially in the girlfriend character. And okay, we haven't even described it yet, and I'm saying girlfriend character, and I'm sure anyone who's read the story is going, what the fuck are you talking about? But yeah, a little bit of gun mall in the girlfriend character. And then it was sort of like surprisingly stuffy and staid. Like Morgan was a little upper crusty, it kind of sounded. And you know, that's what was sort of fascinating about the short story, is that these are like rough frontiersmen. I'm like, why would you go that route, right? But no, aside from that, I wasn't really particularly struck by any of the accents going on. Sorry.
Okay, well, that's what you get when you spring a surprise segment on someone. Anyways, so we open, as in the short story, at an inquest. We find out, but they are again gathered around a torn up corpse, and the coroner is again reading from a journal. And this part appears to be lifted almost entirely just like almost word for word from the short story. And that's actually going to happen throughout, not throughout this, but whenever it's actually adapting the short story instead of fucking around, it will lift huge passages from it, and it's kind of a problem. So here the problem is basically that they're in the modern era, but he's apparently still reading by candlelight, mm-hmm. which is weird. But anyways, so they we start, they're going to call witnesses, which is the first major department from this, more than one witness. The coroner says that they aren't trying yet to assess anyone's guilt. They're just trying to figure out what happened. And so they call up Hugh Morgan's wife, which you're like, wait, what? What? He has a wife now? Great. and they're trying to figure out what happened the day he died. So the wife tells this weird story where Harker, who is a student of Hugh Morgan, and now works as a newspaperman, and he's visited Morgan twice, and apparently he owed Morgan $5,000, which, Claude, you're a teacher, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would you loan your student $5,000 for some reason?
Well, no, I tend not to keep in touch with my students. I like to keep them at bay. Because even when I don't, they send me anonymous death threats. So, no, I would not own my students' money. I would not hang out with my students. I don't want to be around my students. They're my students. They have their lives. I have mine.
Yeah. So she overhears Harker and Morgan talking. And Morgan is like, dude, I really need my $5,000. And Harker is like, well, tell you what, let's go work on let me go write a short story or a believable account in a newspaper about something that she doesn't know what. And then that'll sell for $5,000, which I don't pretend to understand publishing rates, but this aired in 1974. $5,000 would be a pretty crazy advance for a short story or a newspaper account, I think, unless it like brought down the president or something.
Yeah, I mean, $5,000 would be an extraordinary amount of money for a teacher to have. So I say that as a teacher.
I think Harker, they say that he like published textbooks or something. So I think he might be one of those teachers who like actually somehow makes a lot of money doing it.
Well, you know, that's the weird thing. I have a friend who, bizarre aside, I have a friend who wrote a textbook. Like, he teaches, well, I don't want to say what, and I don't want to say where, but the class that he teaches needed a textbook, and they were like, well, why don't you just write one? We'll hook you up with the press. And so he wrote the textbook. It basically did general editing permissions and put everything together for a bunch of literary works. And then because it's the class, he has to assign the textbook. But the university said that he can't take any money for that. So any money he gets out of that, he has to donate. So it actually turns it to a lot of really cool, good causes, like a lot of local theater and stuff like that. He turns it to some really, really cool stuff. I don't want to say his name, though, just to avoid embarrassing him. But anyway, textbooks are like a tricky situation. And I don't know. I don't know if you would be making any money on that.
Fair enough. So Harker had been there once before and seen something crazy, and now he's come back. Morgan's pressing him for the money. And then they're like, well, let's go out to where we saw the thing. Remember, this is all the wife overhearing it. And then I'll write a story about the thing. And we'll make our money back. So they go out, and then the wife hears a noise that we hear, and it sounds, I'm going to say, like a spaceship landing. Claude, what do you think it sounds like?
It has that weird, like, 60s, 70s, sci-fi noise. I mean, it almost sounded like something out of Plan 9 from Outer Space. You know?
Yeah. It's
flying saucer noise, I think, captures it.
Yeah. And then Harker comes back screaming and says that Hugh is dead. And the wife says that Harker is a pathetic weakling who could never defeat Hugh, who was in excellent shape and used to play he used to play high school or college football, and he was a wrestler, which we'll come back later. Apparently he was a bad wrestler. And she thinks that Harker shot Hugh over a debt. And then the coroner points out that the body is too fucked up for them to know if it was shot. And then in my...
No, I was going to say, that was one of the cool details. That was one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting. That, you know, well, we can't tell if he was or wasn't shot because the body is too damaged. That's kind of gruesome. That's kind of gross without, like, spelling it out. And I thought that was, okay, that's an interesting detail. That's one thing that this adaptation has gone.
And so up until now, this seems like it could be a serviceable adaptation. Adding the wife, maybe it's a little bit unnecessary, but it does let you introduce some padding that isn't too much padding. You get to get sort of a first blush of something horrific happening without actually seeing it, which is always something you want in horror because it builds tension. You know, that, you know, you could see at this point this turning into an okay adaptation. And then, according to my notes, things go off the rails because the next witness is Viola May Atwater, the sort of generic pillbilly sexpot who works for the Morgans and is Yu's lover and is pregnant with her child.
Yeah, that's where I was listening to this while I was sort of like in bed, sort of not exactly drifting off to sleep, but, you know, it was the time that I had. And, you know, I had about 30 or 40 minutes before, you know, I needed to really go to sleep. And so my wife was doing work. The kids were down. I was in my room. I had the lights off. I was listening on headphones. And when they brought in the girlfriend, I was like, wait a minute. What the fuck is this?
Is this when you texted me every time, Lawrence, every time they always fuck up adapting these?
Yes. Like, that's why adapt it like this? I mean, that was my question. Okay, I guess Tobe Hooper has his own thing and they want a cool monster. They want this. And the thing about the Tobe Hooper adaptation was it's kind of like a simple moralistic tale in a way.
Don't dig up oil. A monster will eat your kids. Boom.
Yeah.
Done.
It was something. I don't know. It seemed kind of cause and effect, and it seemed sort of indebted to sort of like the Tales from the Crypt comic book style kind of thing. You know, I can get that. I can understand that. That's where a lot of like generic horror kind of goes. But why would you take this particular turn if you're doing this particular adaptation? So yeah, that was what I texted you every time, Lawrence, every damn time.
Yeah, so his wife, whose name I don't have in my notes, knows about this, and Viola May is doing dishes and stuff. She's sort of their servant, and not sort of, she is. And then I have this bit of dialogue written down from the argument that Yu has with her wife, with his wife, which kind of drives home the other weird thing this does, which Yu Morgan, not really much of a character in The Damned Thing. He's mostly just sort of an outdoorsy guy who exists to write in his journal a little bit, question his sanity, and then get eaten or whatever.
Well, can I correct you a little bit? He's really more of a corpse.
Yeah, that's fair. But in this, they, for some reason, they're just like, Yu Morgan, what if he was an absolute piece of shit? So, talking about Viola May, she has something you'll never have. And the wife goes, that's obvious. And Yu goes, I'm talking about compassion. In her own simple way, she has a tenderness. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, fucking the help is a little dicey. Don't be like condescending to her, dude. She's got your baby in her.
Yeah, it's that was the thing. Again, they're making it like a kind of weird moralistic tale in some way, you know,
but not, it doesn't work like that because of something we're about to get to. So then you and his wife go for a walk for some reason, and then Viola May hears the wife push you into the pond. I think she does hear the crazy space noise.
Yeah.
Oh, also, during the fight, the wife had said, you asked for a divorce, and the wife said she'd kill him before she'd give him a divorce. And for some reason, he still decides to go for a walk for her. And then the wife comes back and tells Viola that you drowned in a lake, which not totally contradicts, like, the thing. The wife's tale is sort of broadly reconcilable with The Damned Thing. But this, right, is just... the corpse wouldn't look like that. And this is the point where I started wondering what the hell was happening, because like we've got this totally contradictory story. But then I'm like, well, maybe there's a conspiracy or something. I don't know.
Okay, that was the other thing. So the body is too mangled to determine whether or not it was shot. The body is also too mangled to determine whether or not he drowned in the
pot. No. This is weird. It's even weirder than that. The coroner says that you had no water in his lungs. So he's like, he probably didn't drown. But then it's like, but then why is she saying that he drowned? Why is the other woman saying that he got shot? Neither of those is really that compatible with, like, the fact that his corpse is torn to ribbons. And it's only been, like, 24 hours. It wasn't like it sat out and got eaten by a bear.
And how does he still have lungs?
Yeah. Oh, Christ. And yeah,
it's very confusing.
And then Joe, we next go to Joe Crowfoot, who, as you might guess from his name, is a sort of a stereotypical Native American. This is the 70s, so there was sort of a fascination with the First Peoples. However, I will say they don't have a Native guy voicing him, so boo. But on the other hand, he speaks like incomplete sentences. He never says the word wampum or big mad or anything like horribly racist like that. I think this is probably the best you were going to get out of a Native American character in this.
Yeah.
Which is to say that he's not really in it very much. So he's a guide for hunting parties. In my notes, I note that he has an unfortunate accent. So he's hanging out in his shack, and he hears Viola and you arguing about you not wanting to leave his wife. It goes back and forth a bit. They encounter a snake on the path. You pulls Viola May back, and you think for a sec that maybe he's going to try to kill Viola May, but he doesn't. Then Viola says something or other to piss him off, so you calls her a whore and hits her, which... great. Fucking great work, dude. Good work on everyone involved in this. And then, so Viola pushes him into the snake. He gets bitten by a rattlesnake, and Viola just, you ask Viola to go for help with Joe Crowfoot. But Viola says, no, he wouldn't help you anyways, you suck, and then leaves. And then Joe Crowfoot comes out, takes him back to his cabin, tries to get the venom out, fails, and he dies. And the coroner notes that there was no rattlesnake venom in Joe's system. But now it's not even like hearsay. Now we've got a witness who claims that he's not only that he saw a murder happen, but that he saw exactly how the dude died. Like he died in his arms. So it's really like, what the fuck is going on here, you know? And it's not even like a Rashomon situation where, you know, obviously the particulars are very different in ways that completely change what the act was. But, you know, they sort of agree that the dude died and, you know, broad details on it. It's like none of these accounts are completely contradictory. None of them appears to be true. And there's no explanation given as to why.
Yeah.
It's just weird.
Yeah, okay. It does seem, because you brought it up, it does seem like they're trying to go for some kind of Rashomon thing.
But they fucked it up. And this is a weird thing. So Rashomon is actually based on an Ambrose Bierce story called The Moonlit Road. Like, not the particulars, but the general idea of everyone about, like, being consulted to trying to figure out a murder, including the corpse of the murdered person, and none of them being able to, like, figure it out, and it kind of saying a beautiful thing about life. Although, of course, in Ambrose Bierce telling, it's about how language doesn't work, life is hell, and death is worse, and there's nothing, no joy in anything. But, you know, it's the same structure.
But that's, I mean, again, I could see a Rashomon-style adaptation kind of doing an okay job.
I mean, the fact that the monster, like, doesn't fit into your head would kind of, you could have that be the way that you figure that out, because the people all tell, like, contradicting stories about the attack or something, you know?
Yeah, so why throw in the baby, and why keep messing? It's almost like this needed one more revision. But from what you told me about the CBS Mystery Theater, it was sort of like just slamming these scripts out, hit it and go, kind of just pump it out as quickly as possible, right?
I think so. I mean, there was no one saying you couldn't spend longer on the script. It's just that they were only paying you $350 for the script. So why would you? And this script in particular is very lazy for a reason we'll talk about in a little bit.
Yeah, okay, keep going.
But it is I just, that is the baffling thing about this. Okay, and now Harker finally shows up. He's got a copy of the story he just filed. Here's an important difference here is that he has filed this story as fact, whereas in the Ambrose Bierce short story, he submitted it as a short story.
Yeah.
So he starts telling the coroner what actually happened. Well, not what actually, what I think this is supposed to be the true version, but then you wonder why everyone else was telling weird, elaborate lies, you know? He tells the story first of the first time he and you ran off, and they took the dog out and they were going quail hunting. And this has a bunch of text that is lifted almost entirely from the Ambrose Bierce short story. But the sort of issue I have with that is that Ambrose Bierce was a hell of a prose stylist, I think, in this very specific way where his prose got out of the way and you don't notice it, which is a skill. But he also was never writing like dialect or like a narrator or anything. So yeah. The fact that these characters are suddenly talking in diamond hard 19th century prose is pretty fucking weird, especially since they've spent a lot. Some of them have spent a fair amount of time talking kind of like Hillbilly Hicks, you know?
Yeah.
Christ. Anyways, so they go out. They're going hunting. Sandy, the dog, is there. They hear a strange noise. You see something that Harker can't. There's that space alien noise again. And then the oats start moving, again, almost verbatim from the story. An invisible monster is coming across the grains. They can notice its passage from the fact that the grain is getting crushed. They shoot at it, and then it runs off, and a little while later, they find Sandy absolutely torn apart. And Harker also notes that for some reason he wasn't scared, but you is. And then there's this amazing bit of dialogue where Hugh is like, the thing, the damned thing. And Harker's like, what do you mean? Because Harker is stupid, apparently. And Hugh is like, that's what I call it. Because whoever wrote this also thinks that the audience is stupid.
The audience was back in the 70s. I don't know. But
yeah. So then Hugh tells this weird story about how the damned thing has been tormenting him. Killing his chickens and cattle and Sandy, and he thinks it's coming for him next, which means that while he was also tomcatting around and possibly being an abusive asshole and all this weird stuff, he thought he was also low-key going insane because an invisible monster was stalking him, but he never saw fit to mention it to anyone, and no one even had an idea that that's what was happening, which, nuts. Just nuts.
Yeah, there's... Yeah, I don't even have anything to add. It's just kind of astounding when you think about it. So we've abandoned any kind of realistic character motivation, even though it seemed like the adaptation wanted some kind of realistic character motivation or some kind of dramatic character motivation. But it's okay. Are you pursuing a relationship and having an affair and having all this drama, or are you concerned that the damn thing is coming after you? Like, pick one. Stay in a lane.
Maybe the only reason he found solace in Viola Mae Atwater's loving embrace was to deal with the stress of being stalked by an invisible monster.
You know what? It's not too completely irrational given the context, but, like, pick a lane, story.
Like, literally, the first half of this and the second half of this, aside from a few character names and the fact that Hugh Morgan dies over and over, have nothing in common with one another and no connection whatsoever. And that's where the incompetence comes in. It really does feel like the person wrote a straight adaptation and then they're like, okay, this was, you know, 30 minutes. I need it to be 50. Let's go in and just lard it up with some subplots in the first, but then they forgot to like do a continuity edit, essentially.
Yeah. So that's why I was wondering, was this just like a toss-off? I mean, it kind of seems like it was, so just shrug and move on with it, I guess? I don't know.
At one point, E.G. Marshall does make a feint where he's like, you know, truth is subjective and people don't always know what the truth is, but I mean, that doesn't really explain why these people have told, like, it's not like a matter of opinion whether the dude died in Joe Crowfoot's arms or not, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're gonna have shifting perspectives, you need to at least have that root factuality. Otherwise, it all falls to pieces.
Yeah, like I think Rashomon, the people actually do disagree about like who stabbed the person, but they do agree about where he got stabbed, and you could see either of the cases corresponding with the facts, which is sort of how that story can work. This ends up being baffling and
Right.
just stupid. So anyways, Harker comes back because he really wants to get that $5,000 so he can give it to you. Although they actually don't ever mention the $5,000 in this part either, because I can't, there is basically no connection whatsoever. They go back out over the same ridge. They see the dam, well, they don't see it, but they are apprised of the damn thing's presence again. They try to shoot it, and then Yu gets torn apart. At one point, Yu is telling him, "Be careful, it's real quiet. It comes up on you all of a sudden." And I'm like, it makes fucking noise like a spaceship, man. This is not a subtle animal. And then Yu kind of wrestles the monster as in the short story, but the fact that he doesn't acquit himself better is less obvious here because they've gone to the fat trouble of making him very physically imposing. I'm not saying that it's totally like, oh my God, you know, if the thing's like an invisible bear or something, yeah,
Right.
you can't take that, but it is pretty obvious or pretty weird just how much he gets owned. And at this point, Yu starts speaking entirely in Ambrose Bierce, dialogue to the like his description of the guy wrestling is exactly like Ambrose Bierce wrestling, and when he's talking about like him getting overcome by the superior strength of a foe, it's like, I mean, you do not sound like a guy from the 1970s at all, man. What is going on with this script?
Yeah, it's that's got to be laziness. Just let's just copy and paste. Let's just like throw that in, you know?
Yeah, so then the we've got the same thing where parts of him disappear. The damned thing retreats and Yu dies. And then the coroner says they're about to render a verdict. And Harker says that they need to enter two pieces of evidence. The first is he wants to see the body. So they show him the body. It's really fucked up. And he's beaten and torn and shredded. Curiously, they even pull the description of the body, which is written in kind of 18th century or 19th century like medical terminology that would be quite out of date in the 70s, direct from the story. And then they this so there's a scene in the short story where they're describing like the coroner pulling out all the pieces of the clothing that Yu was wearing and showing them, and they're all like fucked up and covered in blood. And they don't do that here, but they do have one scene, or the coroner also in the short story puts a handkerchief over the corpse, and they never really explain why, but it's pretty clear just modesty. But here they have that same detail, but they explain it as that's the only thing keeping his head on. Which I think means the guy's a bad coroner, but whatever. I know coroners aren't quite undertakers, but I do think that you have to do a certain amount to maintain the integrity of the corpse during the inquest, even in a weird backwoods one, you know?
That would seem to be a necessity.
At the very least, he
Like,
should be using, you know, bandages, not, hey, you know, this thing I blew my nose on earlier today, it's fine, it's fine.
oh Lord. So yeah,
Yeah.
this was an incompetent variation in the story.
We're not quite done yet, though. So we're getting to one of my favorite just what the fuck moments. So the jury again decides it's a mountain lion, but some say that maybe it was Fitz. Although here it's less likely. It's in the beer story, that's a joke. Here it
Right.
doesn't really seem to be a joke. They appear to be actually be suggesting that they think he somehow had an epileptic seizure so violent that it tore his flesh. Then Harker apparently a little while later goes to the coroner and insists on revisiting the verdict, and the coroner's like, yeah, we can't do that, dude, that's not a thing. There's also a marriage mention of a carriage here, and I'm like, man, you got to do a better job on the continuity. I mean, you've already fucked it up so bad, but now I'm like wondering what time this is set. And then oh, also Harker had said, hey, also we should show you the we should read the journal. And again, the coroner's just like, nah, we're not doing that. So anyways, then Harker produces a tape recorder and makes the coroner listen. And we get the whole section from the story about him, from the short story about him seeing the damned thing and his dog reacting strangely to it and all of that, except it's on a tape recorder. And I'm like, okay, then what the fuck was the point of the journal? Because in the short story, of course, all the stuff comes out of the journal and the coroner's withholding this and all this. But here it's like the dude was keeping a journal and then he was also keeping a tape recorder. And that's too many things for one dude, I feel.
Yeah, you can do one or the other. Like, you know, keep it clean.
I mean, both from the both from a like storytelling perspective and from a like life perspective, it's just unreasonable. Also, he mentions that he's going crazy all alone out there, and he needs to see another human being to see so that they can tell him whether he's mad or not. And I'm like, I mean, what about your wife, your lover, Crowfoot Joe, the community that you're apparently fairly well enmeshed in? It seems like you got a lot of options if you want someone to just do a quick, am I crazy on you?
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
And then the coroner says, you know, if you play this for anyone else, they'll think you is crazy, so you should just destroy it. So they argue a little bit, and the coroner says this weird... It's not a Bierce line, but it is an interesting line and a little bit more sophisticated than I would have expected from something like this. I like truth as much as the next fella, but the world needs more things, even more things that are untrue, things that can make you compassionate and kind and loving and hopeful. Which I guess looking at it from one extremely cynical, everything that could make you those things is lies. That is actually Bierce. But it's just such a strange that this coroner embarks on this soliloquy about the power of useful lies and narratives. And then they burn the tape, and then it rains on the corpse, and that's the end. And in the outro, because again, it's apparently some obscure law, that whenever you mention Ambrose Bierce, you have to bring this up. E.G. Marshall mentions Bruce Bierce's disappearance and then suggests that he might have gotten eaten by the damned thing. And that's it.
Done. Yeah, just listen to the LibriVox version. It's like, what, 20 minutes and you're in, you're out, and it does the job.
Okay.
This was bad.
One sec. I need to turn on a light because my room's gotten all spookulated. And then I'm going to make a counter argument, although I'm not sure it's one I believe in.
Okay. So give me the argument that you don't believe in.
Okay. Now, this is something I've tried to say to you before. If this were any other author's, an adaptation, basically any other author, I'd be perfectly comfortable just saying this is incompetence and moving on with my life. I'm going to move on with my life anyways. It's not like I'm going to get super obsessed with this. But Ambrose Bierce is... like, his thing, as I've said, is messing with the reader, like challenging your preconceptions, your notions of truth, your ideas about how things are conveyed, all that stuff. Like, I don't think anything made the man happy, particularly based on his fiction, at least. But if there is something that he liked to do, it was that. So is there any chance that this is just a weird Ambrose Bierce fuck you for expecting it to make sense style anti-story? You ever think of that, Claude, huh, with your big academic brain?
Okay, I think you could make that case, but all right, I'll give you the counter case.
Is it that it's boring and sucks?
No, it has to do with Emily Dickinson. All right, there's so much we don't know about Emily Dickinson. Like, we know everything about her life except what matters, you know? And we have all of these poems that seem to exist with no context. And there's a real issue with how to read them. If you don't have a kind of public context for these private writings, and they're not even exactly private writings because a lot of things she circulated in her letters, but that's still not for the mass public. So without that mass public, or without the context of the mass public and sort of like the mass publishing and the way we think about that kind of publishing operating, it can be difficult to find a verifiable thing to say about the poems, except you've got the context of all the other poems. So you can find insights into a work based on the larger context of the other works. Does that make sense?
So you're saying that the fact that the guy who wrote this, Sam Dan, appears to have written something like maybe 50 other CBS Radio Mystery Theaters.
Mm-hmm.
Oh shit! Apparently, his son invented Cookie Monster. Anyways,
whoa.
Oh, and he wrote an episode of Star Trek, The Conscience of the King, which is not one of the ones you want to have written, apparently, because I don't remember it. But so you're saying that the fact that, oh, it's 29, so none of the other 29 episodes he wrote are possibly weird anti-stories designed to mess with the audience's understanding of reality? That probably means that this one isn't either.
I don't know about his other stories, but within the context of CBS Mystery Theater.
I think he wrote an adaptation of The Death of Halpin Frazier.
All right, so I guess we have our next discussion piece, huh?
Well, yeah, that is one where this one, it's a pretty straight story that just happens to be about how you can't trust your senses. That one, it is like high, weird, what is going on, Beers.
That's kind of interesting, and now I'm kind of curious to see what he does with that one. All right, so we might need to leave the door open to the idea that perhaps this is intentionally, well, not intentionally incompetent, but intentionally leaving pieces out, intentionally ambiguous as to a central verifiable truth.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, we're inclined, because it's CBS Mystery Theater, to say this is hack work just tossed off. On the other hand, because this guy clearly has an interest in Bierce, there might be some kind of working of an epistemological ambiguity. So we'll have to leave the door open, I guess.
Yeah, I'm fucking around. This is garbage. It's interesting garbage, and it's fun to laugh at, and it messes with your noodle in the way that, like, The Room or Manos, The Hands of Fate does. But yeah, if you're looking for a good entertainment, this is not it.
Yeah. So just listen to the audiobook and you're good to go.
Yeah. Let's see. It's actually hard for me to know how long we've run now, but I think we're at about an hour and 10. So you want to try to do a game, or you want to just do recommendations?
Let's do a game and then do some recommendations. If you got a game, I'll play anything.
So, Claude, yeah. What is your perfect day?
Do you want...
Not, don't do it. Dan, on the like episode he was on, we had a perfectly wonderful discussion about what we would get from gas stations as snacks. Just straight answers make magic radio sometimes.
This is going to be sappy and sentimental, but on my deathbed, I will tell you the best time I had in my life. Up until the summer of 2018, the best time I'd ever spent in my life was the summer between eighth and ninth grade, where this buddy of mine had Street Fighter 2 on the Super Nintendo, and I went over to his house every day, and we just sat and played Street Fighter all day until his mom would make us leave the house for an hour, and it was either too hot or we would find some kind of complaint, and then just go back inside and play Street Fighter and listen to the Pixies, because between the two of us, we had all the cassettes of the Pixies. So if you had asked me before 2018 what my perfect time was, that would have been it. It was kind of like a halcyon summer, but something happened. The summer, it was 2016, it was before, before my son turned two, so it must have been the summer of 2018. That summer, the sitter that we had had to quit. Like, she went back to the Philippines to take care of her father because he had a heart attack. So that whole summer was me and my nearly 2-year-old just like on our own. And I was kind of a new dad trying to figure out how things work. And I wasn't teaching over the summer for the first time in like 7 or 8 years. And so it was all new. It was all weird. My wife wasn't around. It was just me and the kid trying to figure each other out. And what we ended up doing was every day, unless it was raining and we would find something else to do, but every day we would just go have an adventure. And the best times were the times where it was sort of like we would set out in the morning and then we'd hit Central Park. And there's this one giant hill in the sheep meadow where there's this huge pine tree, and that was the magic tree. And he would go in and run around, and we would say magic words to open the tree and close the tree. And we could go inside, and then we would run up and down in the sheep meadow. And we would climb these giant rocks that they have there and pretend to be sort of magical creatures like goblins and skeletons and dwarves and elves and all this kind of stuff. And I would tell them stories, and we would draw things in the sand with sticks. And sometimes we would go to the Central Park Zoo, and then come home, and he would take a nap, and I would clean up for an hour and then pick back up, make dinner, and just hang with them. Those days were some of the best days of my life, and I honestly wish I could have some of that back. So my perfect day, I'm sorry to get sentimental and sappy and straightforward, but my perfect day is that day or those days, just hanging in the park lazily with my son inventing adventures, and it was the best, you know.
Yeah.
Sounds but do amazing. You want to hear about? Do you want to hear? What'd you say?
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, but do you want to hear about gas station food? If you and Dan were talking about gas station food,
nah. I want to tell you about my perfect day.
Okay, tell me about your perfect day, man.
Okay, so you took it in a little bit of a different direction, so I'm going to give two answers to that. So first is just like kind of the day that you wish you could relive almost. Mm-hmm. So for me, this is a really weird one, but it's December 16th, 2019. I had gone to Phoenix, Scottsdale, and I woke up. There was an episode of Knowledge Fight on. A new one. It was the second Alex Jones deposition episode, which is a classic episode of Knowledge Fight. So I was listening to that. Yeah. The one where Rob Dew is supposed to be their corporate representative and he hasn't prepared at all. And actually, as we just found out today, he did such a bad job that he literally lost Alex the case. And it's incredible. And I listened to that. And then I went with my dad to the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale. And we filled out a bunch of paperwork. And they took me back, and we watched the first half of the movie Venom. And I was getting pretty nervous, but they gave me some drugs that made me feel better. And then they put me, they wheeled me back. They put me under. They pulled my kidney out. They slapped it in a stranger. And then I woke up, and I was in incredible amounts of pain. And I instantly started telling the nurses that I was a recovering alcoholic, and I would have no opioids whatsoever in my system. So they started giving me Tylenol, which was totally unequal to the task. And I'm sitting there in the bed up there, and occasionally people will come in to check on me. I sent a couple of emails to people at work telling them that I was okay and some text messages and stuff. And I talked to my wife a little bit. And then I sort of was drifting out in and out of consciousness while listening to the What a Cartoon podcast. And I watched Glengarry Glen Ross. And then my dad came, and I don't really know the timing on this when he came, but he talked me into taking some pills. And we watched the second half of Venom, and then we went to a condo. And I remember all throughout this, I was extremely hungry, and I kept asking them for a grilled cheese sandwich. And finally, just before I left, they brought me a grilled cheese sandwich and some grilled cheese and some tomato soup. And it was the most delicious thing I'd ever had. And it hurts so much to walk around the hospital because they had cut open my abdominal muscles. So every time I engaged my core for anything, so I had to like do that thing where you get yourself like insane with fury so that you can ignore the pain. So I was just running around the hospital with like gritted teeth, you know, almost crying from how angry I'd made myself so I could do it. And you know what? I would give almost anything to be able to do that again or to be able to relive that day, because I never thought I'd do anything as shine as that. And I fucking did.
Yeah, that's amazing, man. That's a great one, dude.
Yeah,
it's those weird days that we have that, you know, where something has gone right or we feel like we did that thing that we set out to do. It's kind of perfect.
Yeah, and then I guess for my more perfect, like achievable perfect day where I'm not like giving someone an organ, you get up. I want my dog to be better. And I go run a half marathon. My wife, I come back home. I get my wife up. I make myself some pinon coffee. I order a pizza. And then I spend most of the rest of the day like hanging out with my dog and playing video games and, you know, seeing my wife and maybe watch some dumb TV. And then I go to bed incredibly tired. And that's the best day I can have that it, you know, isn't like physically impossible for me now.
Simplicity, man. It's kind of all about that. Like I want to hang with my family. You know, we don't get much time anymore because we're all working, the kids are in school, and you know, I miss being with them doing silly things. You know, I'm around them all the time, but we don't have that free time. And I think that's sort of what you're getting at, is that the perfect day is kind of the the free time day to experience each other and experience the things that you care about.
Yeah,
I like that.
Anyways, so let's do recommendations and cautions. Claude, yeah. You're the guest, so you should go first.
All right. Yeah, I do have something really to recommend. This was something you recommended to me for this other project that we're working on, and it's Things We Lost in the Fire by Mariana Enriquez. She's an Argentinian writer, and I guess it's sort of like high art horror, but it's been ripping me to shreds. Like I stay up late sort of reading these in bits and pieces because I don't have much time, and I'm just taking it story by story, and it's just unnerving. It's beautiful and creepy and terrifying all at the same time. So I would highly recommend that book if anybody's looking for like a good creepy read.
It's also has the advantage of most of the short stories in it are fairly brief.
Yeah.
Which is quite good for, you know, hey, I want something to read before. Well, not good for before bed because you'll have nightmares or won't sleep, but you know, just 20. I'm doing the audiobook and I think the longest of them is about an hour. And I quite like that.
Yeah. So that's, it's great.
Yeah. And do you have a caution? I think I can guess what it is.
Avoid mulch. I'm in this weird situation. We're renting this house that I hate. I do not like this house. It's they fixed up parts of it, and then others are just kind of like dilapidated and shoddy. And our landlord is kind of like an absentee landlord, except when he's not. So our ice machine is still not working because part of the freezer is just not there. So that was there on the first day, and he still hasn't fixed any of it. It's got this huge yard with nothing in it. And then it's got this, like, all around the house is this garden kind of thing. And the house doesn't have gutters. And we live in a heavy rain area. Like, it rains every other day here. And the house doesn't have gutters. So this garden area, like, that surrounds the house, it was getting really overgrown and washed out. Because there's really fertile soil in there, but there are no gutters. And so it just pools like around the sidewalk and all this other stuff. So my wife told our landlord, hey, I'll mulch for you. And he was like, yeah, okay, fine, go ahead. And so she hooked up this thing, found this company that hooks people up with people who are shredding trees. Like you cut down a tree, you chip it, and usually people who chip the trees don't have anywhere to put it. But they do quality control to make sure there's not like garbage or toxic stuff or like termites or whatever in the tree. And so they'll bring you the chipped up tree. Well, they just dumped it on our lawn. So I was like, oh, Lord. And so I spent like 3 days putting mulch all around the yard. And the next week, the landlord shows up because he wanted to take a look at something and then saw all the mulch and said, oh, no, we have to get this out of here. This will cause termites. Well, our house is termite controlled. They've got like pesticides or something like they termite prevention and stuff like that. We had 7 different experts in, even our exterminator took a look at it. And he was like, no, there's like any kind of mulch that you get is going, unless it's rock, is going to draw bugs. He's like, this is no more or less a termite danger than anything else. You know, and we talked to the guy and he was like, well, you know, I'm not worried about the house. I'm worried about like generations down the road after we're long gone. So you have to remove all the mulch.
So he's worried that the mulch will like give rise to like, what, super intelligent termites that end humanity or something?
I have no idea. And so he's trying to push us to use his guy to take it out for $900, and like he's trying to scam us to make us do repairs on the lawn that he should have done in the first place. And so it's this giant headache, and so now we're trying to figure out how to remove mulch from the garden, and it's cursed mulch, that's all it is. So don't play with mulch. Don't do mulch. Don't do anything. If don't have a lawn. Get rid of lawns. Don't do any gardening. Don't touch dirt. Just avoid all of this altogether. That's my general advice. Things not to do. So don't do yards.
Yeah. Okay, so Claude, for my recommendation. Now, I was listening to our Mask of the Red Death episode, where I of course recommended Hell's Reach, a Space Marines battle book by Aaron Dembski Bowden, and I described it. And you know, kind of, you were pretty quiet, but I got the sense, the vibe, if you will, that you didn't take my recommendation entirely seriously. So this time, I really dug deep, and I found another book. A lesser classic, but a deeper cut. And I think that this one's really going to impress you. I'm talking, of course, about Honor Bound. It is a Severina Rain novel. One sec, let me get the author. Honor Bound. It takes place, it's by Rachel Harrison. It takes place during the Bale Stars Crusade, when the forces of the Astra Militarum are attempting to reclaim the Bale Stars from a chaos cult called the Sighted. I believe they're a Zeech cult, although the book never makes it explicit because, I mean, they're Imperials, so it's unless it's an Inquisitor, it's not like they're going to be able to tell the different flavors of chaos. The plotting is fairly standard. Severina Rain is a commissar, and it's not like the Gaunt's Ghosts novels where she's like hesitatious about her duties or executing her men. She executes someone for cowardice in the first chapter and kills several more throughout, often to put them out of their misery, but occasionally because they refuse to follow orders. And during the course of the fighting, she uncovers a conspiracy that rises to the very top of the Bale Stars Crusade. It's not the most amazing plotting, but the thing that I liked about it, first, it does a remarkably good job of sketching the characters. Severina Rain is interesting in her own right, but the two characters I really liked were Davian Wick and Lydia Zane. Davian Wick is addicted to combat stims, and it's sort of like if he had a cocaine habit, except that the cocaine actually makes him as good as the cocaine made him think he was. So he's popping them constantly and then like absolutely wrecking people's shits and fights, but they're also like killing him, and he's having to deal with the fallout from his addiction while getting into these like insane battles where they're fighting people with laser guns and he'll just like whip out a knife and go ape shit on everybody, and it's really cool. And then Lydia Zane is a Primaris Psyker attached to the regiment. The regiment, of course, being the Antari Rifles. So she, because they are fighting a Kazinchian chaos cult, there are a bunch of chaos sorcerers who are constantly trying to tempt her and turn her to use her powers for chaos. And she is a very frail person. The Antari are a very superstitious people, and they think that psychers are all witches, and she has a very tragic and sad backstory. And she and Wick sort of end up forming an unlikely partnership. And I really enjoyed sort of the sketching of all three characters and the way that they interacted, and seeing Davian Wick just be like incredibly competent at fighting. It also features cameos from several, none of the characters are in the Adeptus Mechanicus, but it features several cameos from Dark Mechanicus units. So at one point you get to see Sicarian, I believe that they are infiltrators, not Rust Stalkers. And then there's also a Catrophon robot that shows up at one point, which is cool. And then the other thing is, because you know, one of the characters is a psyker and the others are, and so many of the people they're fighting are heretic psykers, it does a really good job of sort of driving home the sheer strangeness and horror of the psyker and the immaterium, to the point where in a lot of these novels, when a character is psychic or has some weird power, you're like, wait, why is everyone scared of them? It seems like they're pretty cool, but everyone treats them like a leper, or like in the battle days. Not that lepers need to be shunned now, but in this one you absolutely get it, because like every time Lydia uses her powers, the world breaks a little bit, and they're constantly being shown horrible visions by the psykers they're fighting. So yeah, I highly recommend it. I think that Hell's Reach is a little bit of a better novel, but this is certainly well worth your time. It is a very fun read. And for my caution, Claude, have you ever had to give a dog physical therapy?
Ooh, not yet.
Yeah, my dog had a TPLO surgery, which is the way it's essentially they build them a new knee to deal with the fact that they've torn their ACL, well, the dog equivalent of an ACL. So every day twice a day for the past week or two, I've had to hold him down on his side, ice his leg, put a hot pad on his leg, then spend 20 minutes like digging around in my phone while I'm holding him down and moving his leg, and then ice it. And it is so awful to have to do that to your best friend. Aww. You're like just suffering. You're doing something they do not like. They have to. They my dog like he doesn't complain exactly. He just looks up at you real sad, and it's just it's a real bad time for everyone. It's good that he's got an owner who's willing to do that for him, and that I had the resources to get him that TPLO surgery so that he'll be able to like walk without pain in a couple of months. But still, it's just a bad situation right now. And if you can ever somehow get out of doing physical therapy on a dog responsibly, I'm not, of course, advising you to abandon your pets. People who abandon their dogs are scum. But, you know, it's just a bad fucking time, man. A little bit of a downer there. Anyways,
That's okay. At least he's doing okay. He's hanging in there, you know?
Yeah. And finally, a plug segment. Claude, is there anything you would like to plug?
Yeah, you can check out the Cannonball. Daniel Doty, who's been on here before, he and I have a podcast attempt to read all the books in Harold Bloom's List of the Western Canon. And we kind of stalled a little bit because the summer was really kind of rough for both of us. I moved and trying to coordinate the two kids, but we're getting back on track. And I don't know what we'll be up to by the time this comes out, but we're moving through the romantics and sort of giving a close eye to Wordsworth and Coleridge, and then moving on to Jane Austen. So if that's up your alley, you know, that's kind of cool. But I would recommend if anyone's new to the podcast to check out some of the stuff we did on Cervantes, which I think was the best stuff we've done so far. Don Quixote was a lot of fun. So if you want to start there, you can start.
And even if you're like, hey, I don't really want to listen to a podcast about classic literature, they're very knowledgeable and informative, but they also have pretty good banter back and forth and a very lovely chemistry. So even if you're not sold on the premise, I'd still urge you to check it out.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah. So that's about it.
Anyways, from all of us here at Bad Time Radio, thanks for giving us a listen, and we will return whenever our release schedule that hasn't been set yet dictates. If you'd like to write in with a pedantic correction, a suggestion for a future episode, or a question for the mailbag, you can reach us at radiobadtime@gmail.com. Our theme music is The Machine Stops by Misery Slims. Thanks for listening.